This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 10th of November 2023. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 10th of November. Your readers today are Jill Russell.
Hello.
Norma York.
Hello.
And Andrew Parkinson.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Keith Vincent. And the main headlines this week: plans to redevelop old army base submitted, concern A&E may be closed, and outdoor pool could feature in new plan. So, Jill, may we have the story behind the first headline, please?
One of the biggest planning applications in Winchester's history has been submitted for the redevelopment of a former army base. After years of debate and public consultations, an outline planning application was sent in for Bushfield Camp on Friday, October the 27th. The major scheme includes a business park, academic accommodation, a hotel, retail, parking, sport and community hub, landscaping and public realm works. More than half would be retained as open space. The proposal has been put forward by the church commissioners. The site has been earmarked for business use in the Winchester local plan for more than 10 years. By Tuesday, November the 7th, three objections had been sent, with one supporting comment. Daniel Pilch of Court Road, Winchester, said, "Overall, the plan looks very positive and makes good use of land that is not currently in use. Sustainability seems to be at the heart of the development and, in my opinion, would be a positive for Winchester." Councillor Brian Laming told the Chronicle, the application for the development of the Bushfield site is a massive development and will change this part of the city. It is vital that everyone has a chance to read and digest the planning application. It is important that the parish councils have time to consult and discuss this development with their residents. To that end, I have asked that the time for the consultations to be placed on the planning portal is extended, and that the matter is duly considered by a special planning committee meeting, where more time can be allocated for both the supporters and objectors to raise any issues. It must be remembered that this application has generated great interest and a petition of over 1,500 names has been made. The scheme includes academic accommodation with 525 beds, a 100-bed hotel and 1,055 parking spaces in a multi-storey car park. Joanna Loxton, Head of Strategic Land at the Church Commissioners for England, said, "Bushfield will provide critical employment-led space which will serve Winchester and Hampshire's growing business economy while adding to the diversity of Winchester's employment offer." Ben Rogers, Head of Regeneration for Legal and General's Real Assets Division, said, "Attention is deservedly given to the well-established spheres of life science, innovation and media in the UK. It is important, however, to recognise the importance of supply chains and specialist subsectors that feed creative solutions into them, as they are an essential part of the research and development process. The Church Commissioners for England, Legal and General and Gisborne have worked alongside Winchester City Council to ensure Bushfield delivers both economically and environmentally in support of the Council's declared nature and climate emergency policies. Should the scheme be permitted, work will start next year and last for around 11 years.
Concern A&E may be closed. New concerns have been raised over the possible plans to close Winchester's Accident and Emergency Department and its impact on Southampton. It comes as the NHS is preparing a public consultation in the North and Middle Hampshire to gather views on how to develop this brand new hospital and make potential changes in services. During the Hampshire County Council Joint Health Overview and Scrutiny Committee Officers from Hampshire and the Isle of Wight Integrated Care Board, ICB, revealed plans for a 12-week public consultation that seeks to develop the brand new hospital in Basingstoke, as well as make potential changes to how Hampshire Hospitals NHS delivers acute services. The consultable for the services in the area will primarily cover North and Mid Hampshire, which includes Basingstoke and Winchester, where hospitals are approaching the end of their usable lives. The consultation said it will need replacing, but in a way which will serve the needs of patients for years to come. Proposals have been drawn up for a new hospital near the M3 in Basingstoke, which will impact on services at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital. During the meeting, Councillor Andy Frampton, representing Southampton City Council, said possible plans to close Winchester's Accident and Emergency Department and its relocation to Basingstoke's new hospital could put pressure on the Southampton A&E. An online petition to save Winchester's emergency department has achieved 12,941 signatures. Residents have raised concerns over Winchester A&E since plans for the new hospital in Basingstoke were unveiled. Councillor Frampton said, if that would be the case, how would that be consulted out with the stakeholders, especially with Southampton, because we, the City Council, would see pressure being put on the A&E department. ICB officer Charlotte Hutchings said, we are working closely with the management of the hospital in Southampton, as well as the clinicians providing the service, about what the impact is if we change, close, if the hospital moves, and what impact that would have.
Outdoor pool could feature in the new plan. Major plans for a new development on the edge of Winchester could include an outdoor swimming pool. Bloor Homes hosted a webinar on the theme of how do we build a healthy new community. The master plan for Manor Park was unveiled in July, which includes a park and ride, a primary school, a tennis facility, and a large country park. The scheme at South Winchester Golf Club has plans for about 1,000 homes, and 50% of the site will be retained as green space. At the webinar, James Matcham, Strategic Land Director at Bloor Homes, was asked if the proposals could include an outdoor pool. Campaigners wanted a Lido at the former River Park Leisure Centre site in Winchester, which is earmarked for future use by the University of Southampton. Mr. Matcham said, "We are looking at that. Watch this space." Over half of the site, at South Winchester, will be retained as green space to encourage greater biodiversity. Health and well-being is very high on the political agenda. We want this to be the best it can be for Winchester. We acquired this site as a long-term commitment, and it will be an exemplary new community. The webinar on Wednesday, November the 1st, heard from Dr. Andrew Baroni, Director of Health and Social Impact Assessment at Savills. He said, "We need to work collaboratively with the community. The legacy of this development is significant and enduring. These developments will be here forever, so we can't miss opportunities. The health of the population of Winchester is better than the national average. Winchester is also one of the happiest places to live, but it does have an aging population. Mental health is also showing signs of decline. There are also pockets of deprivation and poor health. There is the loss of a golf course, but we are keeping 50% of the green space, which is ideal. It will reduce pressure to accommodate natural population growth." Dr. Baroni added that the scheme could include a school with high special needs capabilities and a children's home. Bloor Homes acquired the freehold of the golf course in 2021, but reached an agreement with the previous owner, Crown Golf, that the club would be allowed to remain open until at least 2026. The golf club opened in the 1990s after it was previously Manor Farm, and the historical farm structures were incorporated into the club buildings.
Thank you. That concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the death announcements, then Christian comment, letters to the editor, Chronicle comment, first person and Belgarum, and then announcements and what's on. So we start with the death announcements. The deaths announced this week. A. Burrow, Jean Muriel A. Burrow, on the 24th of October, aged 94. Burrows, Albert Henry Burrows, died peacefully at home, aged 88. Clift, Joan Irene Clift, died peacefully at Marlfield Care Home, aged 96. Gilmore, Barry Gilmore, died on the 18th of October, formerly of St. Cross Filling Station. Hayes, D. Hayes, a former resident of Alsford who died on the 13th of October. Lincoln, Dr. Roger John Lincoln, died peacefully at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, aged 80. Linter, Betty Linter, known as Eileen, died peacefully on the 19th of October, aged 92. Mass, that's M-A-A-S-Z, Mass, Anne Mass, nay Spurway, died peacefully on the 13th of October, aged 73. Malpus, Peter Malpus, died peacefully in Gloucester Royal Hospital, aged 94. O'Leary, Michael Robert O'Leary, died on the 19th of October, aged 83. Sylvester, Susan Sylvester, died on the 27th of October, aged 90. And Spears, Trish Spears, who died peacefully at home on the 21st of October. Now, Andrew, I think you've got a Christian comment, please.
This week's Christian comment is entitled Changing Our Story, and it was written by Nigel Hemming, who's the senior pastor at Winchester Vineyard Church. In a rare theatrical treat, we recently travelled up to the West End to see James Graham's celebrated play, Dear England. The play centres on how Gareth Southgate took charge of a failing England football team, helped them to confront the pain of the past, and instilled self-belief, confidence, and national pride over the next 6 years. Part of the misery centred around England's ability to win penalty shootouts in knockout competitions, something they hadn't done for decades. Drawing on his own well-documented experiences, Southgate coached the team to completely rethink the way they face this highly pressurised situation together, seeing powerful results against Colombia in 2018. The play has attracted great reviews. The Evening Standard's Nick Curtis called it a brilliant fusion of sport and art, exploring our nation's character through our national game. He described scenes of Southgate teasing out emotional honesty and team spirit from his players, punctuated by training montages and confrontations with his subordinates and the FA's Greg Clark. Joseph Fiennes led a brilliant cast, and the play zipped along with humour and energy. The journey moved poignantly from dressing room banter and bravado to honesty and emotional togetherness as they dealt with an entire nation's expectations. Particularly moving was the team's response to the horrendous racism some of the players received after losing the Euro final at Wembley. One key moment came near the start when Southgate challenged his squad that they needed to collectively start telling a different story. This relatively simple psychological technique impacted their collective mindset, changing the way in which the players thought and consequently played. Most therapists will tell you that finding a way to change our internal narrative can help us out of a rut and lead to dramatic results. The Apostle Paul encourages the believers in Rome, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your own mind." After his own dramatic encounter with Christ on the road to Damascus, Paul's story took a vastly different direction from being a passionate persecutor of Christians to becoming a radical evangelist and church planter. Many people have overcome tremendous pain and dysfunction by allowing their minds to be captivated and renewed by the love of God in a way that changes their story forever. The invitation is to die to self and embrace new life in Jesus Christ, leading to hope, life, and kingdom values, stands in dramatic contrast to the self-centeredness championed by much of our surrounding culture. Saint Ignatius encourages us not to fix our desires on health or sickness, wealth or poverty, success or failure, a long life or a short one, but instead to allow everything to call forth in us a more loving response to God, deliberately telling ourselves as different story can be a powerful way to drive change, and it can be a lifetime's work. But, as Gareth Southgate knew only too well, it can also achieve dramatic results.
Thank you. Now we move on to letters to the editor. Jill, can we have the first, please?
A letter from Nick Ray of Fordington Avenue in Winchester, headed Police in Action. Hampshire Police recently justified failing to act on road raids on St Paul's Hill, despite video evidence, with this statement. The department that reviews these cases is resourced for 14,000 incidents per year, but is currently receiving 23,000 reported incidents per year. Yet the police have other options available to them. Prosecution may be time-consuming, even if justified, but many poor drivers might think twice about their behaviour the next time on receiving a letter or a visit from the police, knowing that they have been seen. It is not Old Testament vengeance, but behavioural change that most victims of bad road users would like to see. UK police forces need to think whether solely analysing crime statistics or prosecutability are sufficient on their own. Even with limited resources, the police can attempt to better use what they have. Otherwise, reckless, aggressive, and potentially dangerous individuals surely know that they have a licence to break the law. Meanwhile, Hampshire's Crime Commissioner, Donna Jones, is more interested in appearing on TV channel GB News, idly speculating on immigration and national crime, while our under-resourced local law force tell us that they can't police even the basics. For those who care about law and order and justice, surely it's time for a change in government, police funding, police strategy, and police commissioner too.
Eileen Berry writes about community praise in week. There is no doubt in my mind that the world is in trouble, but closer to home in Winchester, there is so much good being done by many volunteers. I happened to observe activities at Week Community Centre, and it occurred to me that not only were they doing communal work, by the way, means people interact with each other and provide for each other. I observed a funeral, which was one of the happiest things I've ever seen, and also a children's tea party. You can tell the spectrum went from young to elderly. Then a social evening, with Nepalese people enjoying a festive time. I've never seen such beautiful, wonderful colourings and happy people. Young girls and young men all dressed in the most beautiful sparkling clothes. What really magnified this evening was the national anthem. Our national anthem was played. It wasn't at the end of the evening, it wasn't at the beginning. It was among the festivities. They all sang as one and stood up. For me, it struck a chord. I couldn't have been more proud. It gladdens the heart to see that what people think of our country. This particular social club can't keep up with all the people who want to hire their facilities, and I, for one, enjoy what they have on offer. 9 out of 10 people are good and kind-hearted, so it's up to us, isn't it, to keep that good work going, and from little acorns Great Oaks Grow, and that was from Eileen Berry, Priors Dean Road, Hairstock, Winchester.
And here we have Joe Powell, who's writing in to congratulate our local NHS. Speaking at the COVID inquiry, Helen McNamara said there was a, quote, absence of humanity, unquote, at the heart of government during the pandemic. My experience of frontline NHS staff in Winchester could not be more different from this picture of national government. McNamara's notion of humanity resonates with me in particular, as it perfectly captures my recent experience of Winchester's A&E. Admitted twice by ambulance in recent weeks, I cannot praise the staff enough. On the first occasion, diagnosed with a serious problem, I was scared and in a lot of pain. The second occasion fortunately proved to be a false alarm. But each time, I was treated as a person, not just a patient. The staff were kind, friendly, and thoughtful. Even when dealing with the frustrations of failing computers, they remained calm and professional and responded to me as an individual. And the ambulance staff who took me to Winchester and the 111 staff who organized it were all equally caring. Winchester A&E serves a vital function across the city and wider area. Its closure at any point in the future might make economic savings, but would represent a further absence of humanity on the part of our decision makers. And that's from Joe Powell, Seward Rise, Holtworth, Romsey.
This letter is from Julian Perkins about bad loos. In January this year, I addressed a cabinet meeting of Winchester City Council with regards to the desperate state of the public toilet facilities, especially disabled ones, in Winchester. I was assured that plans were in place for major improvements. In July, following an embarrassing experience due to a lack of facilities, I made a complaint to the City Council, who arranged for me to have a meeting with the contract manager responsible. During that meeting, I was made aware that expenditure of £850,000 had been authorised to update all the facilities in the Winchester district. That programme has started, and the facility in the centre of Winchester, the one with the greatest footfall, will be the last to be upgraded. In 11 months, the only action at the disabled covert site was the fitting of a cheap coat hook, fitted so low that any coat hung on it would hang on the ground in the often polluted area. I despair. That letter was from Julian Perkins of Highgate, Winchester.
Reassuring goodwill gesture. I must send my thanks to the person or persons who left flowers at the feet of the statue of Licorice in Jury Street. As a son of refugees who fled the Nazis in 1939 and made their home in Winchester, it is shocking to see the current huge increase in incidents of Jew hatred in this country. This local demonstration of goodwill is reassuring to people who are not personally involved in any dispute but want to carry on their lives in Britain in peace and harmony with their neighbours. Freedom of speech and all that allows everyone to have their say in an essential part of our society. It means even minorities can express their views, but it does not allow people to be free to racially abuse, incite hatred, or instigate physical attacks. There is so much noise created by bullies in this world. Seeing people communicate their feelings quietly and subtly is exceptional and a powerful way to convey a message. And that was from Danny Habel of Beer Close Week, Winchester. And there is a picture of Licorice statue outside the Ark in Jury Street.
And this letter is entitled The Overlooked Old. Having read the Ian Tate, who's an ex-city councillor, letter regarding building on open green space in Abbotsbarton, he appears to be out of date regards affordable housing in Winchester. Chronicle, November 2nd. According to Gillian Knight, head of Winchester City Council Housing, the urgent housing need is for the 80-plus age group, with current needs having increased, plus forecasts showing a 60% increase in the next 10 years or so. Even Jeremy Hunt is coming under pressure to treat this overlooked section of the community with some priority. And that's from Alan Parker, Berry Week Close, Week Winchester.
Thank you. That concludes the letters. And now we have the Chronicle editorial comment, please, Jill.
The Chronicle editorial this week is headed Major Scheme on the Edge of the City. A process that started more than 40 years ago has reached a key stage. When the Ministry of Defence vacated Bushfield Camp on the edge of Winchester in the late 1970s, it was always likely to be redeveloped. For many years in the 1980s and early 1990s, the landowner, the Church Commissioners, proposed a major superstore on the land. Now the Commissioners, which must generate income to pay the pensions of Church of England staff, is applying for the go-ahead for a major business park, but with more than half the site of chalk downland to be retained for nature conservation. The site was earmarked for business use in the local plan by the ruling Conservative group more than a decade ago. So Bushfield Camp will be developed. There is no question about that. The camp is considered, quote, brownfield, close quote, in planning terms, even if it has been unused for decades. But the devil is always in the detail. It includes, quote, academic accommodation, quote, with 525 beds, a 100-bedroom hotel, shops, a sports and a community hub, and 1,000 parking spaces. Is this really what Winchester wants or needs? Placing students to live on the edge of the city does on first sight not appear to be the best idea, not least for the thousands of daily car journeys it could create.
Thank you. Now we have first person, Norma, please.
And this is by Khalid Aziz, and he says, I am a goldfish. It's October 1984. We've been waiting all year for a suitable weather window to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the first crossing of the English Channel by the Montgolfier brothers. They had completed their crossing south to north. We were to make our attempt from north to south. I was co-pilot and navigator due primarily to my possession of a radio licence thanks to my experience as a fixed-wing autogyro pilot. After waiting all year, finally the forecast looked good for Friday the 26th of October. Problem. As best man to a good friend who was due to get married on the Saturday, on the Thursday evening I was hosting a stag dinner in Alsford. Not to be put off, at 3 a.m. on Friday, the balloon team scooped me up and we drove to Folkestone to spy out a suitable launch site. As dawn broke, everything was shrouded in fog, which didn't clear until midday. Once airborne, we could see the coast of France clearly. For the first couple of hours, we drifted southwards with a benign northerly of 5 to 10 knots. Navigation in a balloon is a matter of plotting where you have been and trying to predict where you might end up. With no GPS, it was sightseeing every 10 minutes, plotting on the chart. After about 2.5 hours, it dawned on me that the wind was backing from a helpful northerly to westerly. Next stop would be Holland, or if we were really unlucky, Denmark. We had extra tanks, but I calculated we just didn't have enough gas to make landfall. I put out an emergency radio call and then had a brainwave. Cross-channel ferries were buzzing to and fro beneath us. Surely we could land on one of those. The pilot concurred. He'd give it a go. A sea-link ferry duly lined herself up, sailing with the prevailing wind. The ferry got to within half a mile of us and then inexplicably stopped. The channel is relatively shallow between Dover and Calais. If you were to stand St Paul's Cathedral in the deepest part, the entire dome would still be visible. 4 miles off the French coast, it was just too shallow for the ferry. By now, the Belgian Air Force, Sea King, was standing off. We elected to ditch. The balloon came down to a few feet above the water. I jumped out, and within 10 minutes, I had been winched aboard the helicopter. Another 10 minutes, and we had the pilot, too. As we flew off to the Kojisi airbase, some 70 kilometres away, we saw our balloon being chased by the French Coast Guard cutter. Eventually, our chase team found us, and we managed to get the last ferry of the night back to the UK, arriving back in Hampshire at about 2 a.m. on the Saturday morning. After a few hours' sleep, I was up and ready to drive the groom from deepest Hampshire to Brighton. Meanwhile, the bride at her parents' house was awakened by her mother brandishing a copy of the Daily Telegraph with a front page picture of our balloon being taken from the Sea Link ferry, together with the story which named me — in those days I was the anchorman for TVS's 6 o'clock news programme — causing no small amount of consternation in the mind of the groom's mother-in-law-to-be. Happily, we made it to the wedding, and I had some extra material for my best man speech. The Goldfish Club was set up in 1942 to celebrate those who had survived ditching in the sea. I only heard of it this summer from a fellow guest at a lunch who was proudly sporting the club tie. I wrote to ask if I qualified. By return, they confirmed I did. Your humble servant is now officially a goldfish. Can there be a higher honour?
That's very good.
It's very good. And now we have Bulgaram with an alternative look at the news. The first article is "The Crowd Push Down Fencing." Impatient firework display goers barge down security fencing to get out of the city park. Scores of people scrambled through the open temporary fencing at River Park in Winchester on Saturday evening. The 65th display was organised by Winchester Roundtable Bonfire and had included traditional torchlight procession through the Broadway, or from the Broadway. Thousands of people attended the event at the park, which has only 5 exit points. Unlike most, many people were not prepared to wait, and 2 breaches were made in the fencing, one at the River Park car park and the other near Dutton Bridge. But for many, it backfired, as it took them into a dead end and an even longer wait to get out of the park. Security staff told them to retrace their steps back through the gap in the fence. And a spokesman for the roundtable said, "This year's Winchester Roundtable Bonfire and Fireworks was a magnificent evening, raising thousands of pounds for local charities, and we thank everyone who came for their kind donations and respect for each other and the steward's instructions. We are reviewing the matter, and we continuously improve how our event is coordinated every year." And this is accompanied by a photograph of I don't know whether these were the people that knocked down the fencing, but certainly some of the people going through the gap in the fencing, which looks like it got a little bit out of control. Along with that, the Chronicle Bonfire volunteers. So 6 members of the Hampshire Chronicles team gave up their Saturday night to volunteer at Winchester's fireworks event. The night put on by Winchester Roundtable attracted more than 20,000 people to the city on Saturday, November the 4th. And as well as being one of the city's greatest or largest community events, money raised from ticket sales goes to help good causes supported by the Round Table. And the newspaper staff volunteered as stewards for the evening, helping members of the public, answering questions, checking tickets, sorting rubbish, directing crowds, and much more. And that is accompanied by a photograph of 6 of the Hampshire Chronicle team, and all looking very chirpy, I would say. This obviously is taken during the day because it's daylight, Yeah, but there's the Hampshire Chronicle team getting themselves organised to help out as stewards. And the final bit is a bit of Roman history is disappearing behind weeds. The history of Winchester is well known. How the Iron Age settlements at Orams Arba and St. Catherine's Hill were replaced by the conquering Romans' founding of Venta Belgarum, which of course leads to Belgarum, this section in the paper. Much Roman city history is still unknown, but the streets where we walk and drive today are based on those built by the Romans and amended by the Saxons. There is only one visible piece of city wall from the Roman period, which ran from about 50 to 410 AD. It's inside a sort of gated grotto on the Weirs, close to the Bishop on the Bridge pub. The problem is that the little bit of wall is being overgrown by weed. The plaque has the city emblem on it, so surely the city council could send someone to spend 10 minutes tidying it up. Belgarum has asked.
Thank you. Now we have the What's On feature. Firstly, just to remind you, I think we've done it the last couple of weeks, to remind you that the Wanston Community Cafe, which is held in the Victoria Hall at Sutton Scotney on the third Wednesday of every month, next week, the 15th of November, between 9:30 and 12 o'clock, the Community Cafe will be there for coffee and cake. And all proceeds for that particular week or month is in support of Winchester Talking Newspaper. So we're very pleased to be involved and for them to support us. So if you want to come and join us or know anybody who wants to come and join us for a very social morning, it's at the Victoria Hall at Sutton Scotney next Wednesday between 9:30 and 12 o'clock. Secondly, United Church in Drury Street on Wednesday the 18th of November. No, that can't be right. We can't have the Wednesday the 18th and Wednesday the 15th, can we? But that's what it says in the article. Let me just check. It says, oh no, sorry, I apologise. It's Saturday, November the 18th at 3 o'clock. So it's Saturday, not Wednesday. That's my writing. And it's raising money for those affected by the war in Ukraine. So the performance is by the Kennett Accordion Orchestra. And there's a guest artist, Ukrainian accordion player Vladimir Vasilenko. And Vladimir is a talented musician who has had to leave Ukraine with his family because of the war. So that's at the United Church in Drury Street on Saturday, the 18th of November at 3 o'clock. The Christmas Lights Switch On takes place on Thursday, the 16th of November at 4 o'clock in the Broadway. And then the following day is the start of the Christmas market in the grounds of the cathedral, and that's on Friday the 17th of November and goes up until the 21st of December. It's open every day from 10 till 6 and evening opening till 8 on Fridays. And lastly, there is a concert, a nativity concert at the Boaz Project, which is a Hampshire charity for adults with learning disabilities, and that's at, in a barn at Hill Farm in Sutton Scotney. They have real donkeys and sheep and the Andover Salvation Army Band. That's on Friday the December the 1st at 7 p.m. and members of the of Boaz will tell the story of the birth of Jesus from the perspective of a curious sheep. Sounds interesting. So you can head inside to soak up the atmosphere of this special time of year with mulled wine and mince pies. Everyone is welcome, but you do have to book. So if you go head to the Boaz website, and that will guide you through to get the tickets. Now, lighting up time ends on Friday the 10th of November at 7:13 a.m. and begins at 4:25 p.m. And next Wednesday, the 15th of November, it ends at 7:21 a.m. and begins at 4:18 p.m. And if you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our free recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received, please contact us on 01962 861 229. And that number is also found on the key fob attached to the memory stick. So now we continue with items of general news. Jill.
This item is headed calls for the county to have a mayor. Calls have been made for Hampshire to have its own mayor with devolved powers in a bid to boost the county. A major report published earlier this week makes the case for a strong mayoral office, together with a lobbying group promoting the county as the UK's southern gateway, in a move akin to the work of the Northern Powerhouse. Key leaders across Southampton have contributed to the white paper called Unlocking Hampshire's Potential, including Port Director Alistair Welch, University Hospital Southampton Chief Executive David French, and University of Southampton Vice-Chancellor Professor Mark E. Smith. The paper, compiled by the city's Paris Smith legal firm, calls for a united approach to unlocking investment and says action must be taken now. It says, the fallout from Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic, combined with the cost of living crisis and the competition for levelling up funds, means that now is the time to act. Complacency isn't an option, particularly in the battle for public funds. Hampshire County Council has already pitched for a pan-Hampshire devolution deal, including the Isle of Wight. In the report, Rob Humby, County Council leader, said, what the North are better at is that they do all their dirty washing behind closed doors, but when they speak publicly, they speak as one voice. That is very powerful. We need to be better at doing that. The biggest challenge will be in finding common ground in a county which is so economically, geographically, and socially diverse. This includes broaching traditional rivalries between the neighbouring port cities of Portsmouth and Southampton and marrying their needs to the larger rural and agricultural areas that dominate much of the county, not to mention northern hubs such as Basingstoke and Aldershot, which might feel more aligned with neighbouring Berkshire and Surrey. Peter Taylor, senior partner at Paris Smith, said, Hampshire's diverse assets provide the ingredients for a compelling story. However, it is vital that stakeholders speak with one voice to attract and retain investment. The findings in this report provide a roadmap grounded in the insights of local leaders. I am grateful to the many contributors for sharing their expertise. And the article is accompanied with a photograph of Peter Taylor of Paris Smith.
Village to salute a special soldier. Swanmore, in the heart of the Meon Valley, like almost every other village, town and hamlet across the county, will be remembering their fallen on the coming days. This year, the village will be commemorating the individual headstones of those men and women buried in the churchyard who died as a result of their wounds with hand-knitted poppies. Their names are also commemorated on both the war memorial and the roll of honour in St Barnabas Church in the village. During the research into their stories, accredited community safety officer Gary McCulloch discovered that one soldier buried there doesn't have a headstone. Gary, who is also the memorial custodian of the village, has researched Private Thomas John Whiting of the Hampshire Regiment and found that he joined the army in 1907 and served in the South Africa and Mauritius before his regiment was sent to France as part of the British Expeditionary Force at the start of the Great War. Initially thought to have been killed in action at the end of 1914, news arrived in 1915 from the German government that he'd been captured, having been gassed. A Swiss Red Cross recorded a prisoner swap in October 1918, and his documents show that he had a persistent strong cough. Gary said, I haven't been able to find any relatives that were still alive at the end of the war, and his last known relative was his brother, who had been killed in 1914 at the Battle of Somme. After the war, I believe that Tom was living with part of the Pink family of Bishop's Waltham. Gary's research also showed that the Pink family had also lost sons to the war, including in the same regiment as Private Whiting. Thomas John Whiting died on May the 16th, 1919, and was buried at St Barnabas Churchyard with full military honours, which was overseen by the Regimental Sergeant Major McCathews of the Hampshire Regiment. The service was officiated by the Reverend E.F.S. Ramsbottom. The actual location of his grave is not known because the records were stolen during a break-in in the church in the 1990s. At this time, Tom had no headstone, which is something that Gary is working to rectify with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Gary said, "When I contacted the commission, I was told that Private Whiting is what is referred to as a non-commemorated person, which means that they have been missed, and this is something that the commission is working hard to rectify, even today, all across the Commonwealth." Gary also supplied the CWGC with his evidence, including Tom's death certificate, and the village awaits the commission's decision. It is hoped that Private Whiting will get the CWGC headstone and that it's placed next to another fallen resident, Lance Corporal Cecil Victor Percival, who died in similar circumstances in late 1918. Gary will be with other residents at the Village War Memorial at 11 a.m. on Saturday, November the 11th, to commemorate the armistice of the Great War, and then again at 11 a.m. on Sunday, November the 12th, to remember the fallen of the First World War and all the subsequent conflicts. And there is a picture of a headstone which says, "Buried elsewhere in this churchyard," and it was the C.V. Percival headstone with some poppies at the base of it.
Protest against oil well drilling. Climate groups took to Winchester High Street to seek support for a campaign against oil drilling. Three Winchester-based groups spoke to people on Saturday about the Avington oil well near Cheesefoot Head. The proposal from iGas Energy Limited is for the retention of well site and existing surface and subsurface infrastructure for a further period of 5 years in order to allow for further appraisal of oil and gas. A spokesman for the campaign said, "Today we are highlighting the fact that increasing oil extraction in a year when climate collapse has devastated much of southern Europe with wildfires, heat waves and floods is frankly madness. Prioritizing short-term commercial gains over the threat of global heating demonstrates a total disregard for local communities and the world at large. We plan to do everything we can to stop Avington Oil." The plans at the well near Matley Farm were refused by the South Downs National Park in 2020. However, it was overturned at an appeal in 2021. Appraisal of the site had taken place from 2009 to 2017, but ceased due to fluctuating international oil prices. A spokesman for iGas Energy Limited owner, Star Energy Group PLC, said, "There is no question the UK will continue to need oil. We are not currently in a position to rely solely on renewable energy sources. UK-produced oil offers emissions savings over five of its top six suppliers, and imports do not offer the economic, environmental, or geopolitical benefits offered by domestic production. The Avington site is an existing site that already contains all the infrastructure required for, quote, the proposed oil exploration. It is not our intention to detract from the experiential qualities of the national park. In respect of emissions, all UK onshore oil and gas sites must receive a permit from the Environment Agency in order to operate. The permit includes a gas management plan detailing how the site will minimise the impact on the environment. UK regulations for gas management are very strict, which can include planned emission releases. These are typically very low in volume, and in the case of Avington, are equivalent to the annual methane emissions of 8 cows, which is something that I find hard to get my head around. I assume it's true. And this is accompanied by a photograph of the climber groups on Winchester High Street by the cross with their sign, Stop Avington Oil.
Hannah makes sense of career in plumbing. A Winchester plumber has shared what it's like to be a woman in a male-dominated industry as demand increases for tradeswomen. 4% of the overall trades industry is made up of females. However, according to research by My Local Toolbox, the number of homeowners searching for tradeswomen has increased significantly, with search terms such as Lady Plumber Near Me rising by 450% over the past year. Hannah Lewis runs Winchester and Romsey business Plumbing Bird. Miss Lewis, 49, started her career in 2008 after doing a day taster session at a plumbing academy. She said, "Being practical, plumbing suited me more than other trades. So 15 years ago, I signed up for all the relevant courses. A typical day consists of 3 to 5 maintenance jobs, for example, gas appliance servicing, repairs, radiator valve replacements, some plumbing maintenance, although I prefer heating systems only these days. Building up relationships with my regular and loyal customers, some of whom I can call my friends after many years, is the most rewarding part of being a tradeswoman. My trade is very physical, and I've suffered some joint and back problems. However, there are less strenuous jobs that I can specialise in, which are less likely to cause problems, such as boiler servicing." When asked how customers feel having a female tradesperson handling their work, she said, "They generally appreciate it if any tradesperson turns up on time, does the job well, and leaves it tidy." My Local Toolbox hopes the next generation of tradeswomen will be inspired by Hannah's success. Advising how women should start their trades career, the Winchester plumber said, "Look for a college that offers a trade taster day so that you can decide whether it's going to be for you or not before embarking on the courses. It may seem daunting to begin with, but if you enjoyed learning the theory and practical workshops of the trade throughout college, there's nothing holding you back. You will gain valuable experience through making mistakes, but this is part of getting it right and becoming an expert. As long as you come back and remedy ongoing problems, your customers will appreciate your work and honesty." And the article's accompanied with a photo of Hannah Lewis at work, and it looks as if she's repairing a boiler.
College former head dies at 98. A former head of Winchester College has died aged 98. John Thorne led the school from 1968 until 1985 and has been listed as one of the most influential heads. Mr. Thorne was born in Chiswick in April 1925 and went to Colette Court before winning a scholarship to St. Paul's. In 1943, he won a deferred scholarship to read history at Corpus Christi, Cambridge, and joined the Royal Navy, rising to the rank of sub-lieutenant. He started teaching at Clifton School in Bristol in 1949, soon taking over its history department. He became a housemaster in 1957. In 1961, aged 36, he became headmaster of Repton and moved to take over Winchester in 1968. He had a clear vision of the changes he wanted to make, including making more scholarships available for boys from state schools. To finance this, he approved the controversial sale to the British Library of the manuscript of Malory's Mort d'Arthur, believed to be the copy from which Caxton had set his first edition. Mr. Thorne justified his decision by claiming that the the revenue from the sale brought remarkable boys to the school. He also helped the college embrace other disciplines, realizing the importance of a science syllabus as rigorous as that of Latin or Greek, and introducing the teaching of English as a proper subject. Mr. Thorne transformed the school gymnasium into a theatre, the sanatorium into an art school, and gave music an injection of funds for scholarships. The school orchestras took on increasingly ambitious works. He died on October the 20th and is survived by a son and daughter.
Christmas tree goes up in the city centre. A Christmas tree has been put up in the middle of the city centre. Ahead of the annual light switch-on and the cathedral Christmas market, the Christmas tree has been put up in the city centre. It was put up on Monday, November the 6th, a week ahead of when the festive celebrations begin. The Christmas light switch-on is taking place in the Broadway, outside the Guildhall, on Thursday, November the 16th. The annual Christmas light switch-on is organised by Winchester BID and sponsored by Dutton Gregory Solicitors. Throughout October, the general public voted for a local hero who would be asked to turn on the lights and the Christmas tree. Nominations for the local hero closed on Tuesday, October the 31st, and will be selected by a panel before being announced at the event. Previous heroes included Jessica Giles and Lily Lomas. With Heart Radio hosting, there will be Santa's Sleigh and live performances from Hairstock Primary School Choir, the Pilgrim School Chamber Choir, Winchester A Cappella, Integrate Dance, Theatre Royal Winchester, Spitfire Sisters, Rock Choir, and the Diva Academy. There will also be a Christmas tree and events in the Brooks Centre, with the free soft play being temporarily closed until the new year. And this is accompanied by a photograph of the Christmas tree, which is now erected, and I guess they're now starting to decorate it.
A sad article. A woman who died alone with her cats. An extremely reclusive woman died at her home and was found surrounded by dead cats after services tried to contact her many times and inquest heard. Diane Robbins, 82, was discovered dead in her home in Stanmore, Winchester, on October the 5th, 2021. Miss Robbins of Fox Lane was found in a state of decomposition at the bottom of the stairs when a housing officer for Winchester City Council, Samantha Cherrett, attended the flat to issue an injunction allowing access to the property. Due to the state of her body, the cause of her death could not be determined. The inquest heard from neighbour Robert White that there were 15 dead cats found in the flat and a number still alive that were rehomed. Mr. White, also of Fox Lane, said that while he was not close to Miss Robbins, he and other residents started to check on her during the COVID-19 pandemic to ensure that she was okay. This included leaving food for her if it looked like she had not left the house and calling in police officers for welfare checks when they were concerned about her safety. According to Dr. Debbie White, a GP at St. Paul's Surgery, Miss Robbins had not attended the surgery since 1997. Dr. White, no relation to Mr. White, said that concerns were raised over her welfare in January 2021. When she visited her home on January the 19th, Miss Robbins did not open the door to her, with Dr. White recalling a strong smell of cat urine and excrement at the property. Dr. White passed her concerns on to local agencies, including Adult Services, Winchester City Council, and the RSPCA. The inquest heard that representatives attempted to contact Miss Robbins, but she refused to speak to them, with the services deciding that she had mental capacity to make decisions. However, there were still concerns raised about her living conditions, with different agency figures trying to reach out to Miss Robbins, with attempts being ignored. Concluding the inquest, Mr. Pegg said, Miss Robbins was an elderly lady. She had lived at her property for a number of years. She was extremely reclusive. The evidence I have before me is that she was independent, and there was no evidence that she did not have capacity. There is no evidence that she was unable to make decisions for herself. Her living conditions were considered insufficient by the local authority. Their attempts to reach out were ignored. The last time that anyone saw Miss Robbins alive was in July 2021. It is not clear how she died. The only conclusion we can give is an open conclusion.
Top Dog is part of Uni Team. One of the University of Winchester's most popular staff member, Darcy the Golden Retriever, has been named Service Dog of the Year. Darcy took the top spot this year's Canine Awards run by pet food company Benefit Natural. The award-winning Golden Retriever is an assistance dog to Jess Green, who is a personal assistant to Professor Emil Borgensen, Director of Research and Innovation at the University. Jess has a daily migraines as well as ME, myalgic encephalomyelitis, and chronic pain. Darcy picks up things Jess has dropped, fetches the post, finds misplaced items like phone or keys. The assistant dogs also help Jess get dressed and can unload the washing machine. Jess said she can even fetch a drink or food items if needed. Darcy is very popular around the campus. She loves coming to the office and making everyone smile. Jess has had Darcy now four since she was a puppy and has qualified as her assistance dog in September 2022 after training with a charity Dog AID. And there is a lovely picture of Jess and Darcy sitting at the desk, and both look, well, Jess is smiling and the dog is looking very serious.
And continuing our animal theme for another section here, hedgehogs stock up and prepare for hibernation. Recognisable by their trademark spines, hedgehogs are a familiar sight in our gardens and green spaces during the warmer months. But as the temperature drops and their preferred prey becomes less abundant, these small mammals are busy stocking up on crucial fat reserves. Hedgehogs are one of the few species in Britain that hibernate over the winter, and will start their hibernation around November. To ensure their survival, hedgehogs must accumulate a large amount of fat reserves, and autumn becomes a race against time for them, when they intensify their foraging efforts. To prepare, hedgehogs will consume a substantial portion of their body weight every day. The European hedgehog will need to eat about 110 grams of food per night to reach their optimal weight. One critical aspect of their diet is the consumption of high-calorie, high-fat foods. These calorie-dense offerings help hedgehogs build up the fat stores they need to endure the long winter. Hedgehogs are omnivorous, meaning that they eat both plant and animal matter, and are natural pest controllers, as invertebrates are their most common prey. As a largely nocturnal species, their acute sense of smell and hearing mean they are highly efficient hunters. They eat all kinds of invertebrates, including earthworms, plus amphibians, birds' eggs, and fruit. They also feast on insects and small mammals, including caterpillars, and particularly like big, crunchy beetles. A healthy hedgehog preparing for hibernation will typically weigh around 600 to 700 grams before entering this dormancy phase. This weight ensures that they have enough fat stores, as hedgehogs can lose up to a third of their body weight during hibernation. By achieving this weight goal, they can increase their chances of surviving the winter. The autumnal garden is a banquet for hedgehogs. Fallen leaves provide a treasure trove of hidden insects, and the last fruits and berries of the season become a gourmet meal. It is crucial for gardeners to leave some areas of their gardens wild and untamed, as these provide the perfect hunting ground for hedgehogs and a safe shelter for hibernation. The Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust recommends creating hedgehog-friendly habitats in your garden. These can make a world of difference for these wonderful creatures. Simple measures include leaving out a shallow dish of fresh water and providing safe, dry places to hibernate can significantly boost their chances of survival. Hedgehogs often make nests in piles of leaves and log piles called a hibernacium. I think that's right, a hibernacium. As autumn progresses, these cozy shelters become essential for their impending hibernation.
Volunteers make a difference at Hillside Park. Volunteers have been working hard on a Winchester Hillside Park. The Friends of St Giles Hill Park were out making good use of new tools and equipment funded by grants from Winchester City Council and Hampshire County Council. Friends Chairman Harry Mycock of Quarry Road said that the equipment had already made a difference to what may be tackled in the park, and said that he was grateful to councillors Chris Edwards and Dominic Hiscock in supporting the funding application. Before this year, the park was looking increasingly neglected, with the City Council under financial pressure. The Friends, established as a charity in April, began operating working parties in late August. The focus so far has been on clearing pathways, aiming to make the main routes more inviting, and also on clearing the railings, making them ready for painting. The final working party of the year was on November the 4th. Friends activities will continue, and on December the 2nd there will be a litter pick at 10 a.m. The City Council is planning a tree planting session on December the 9th, following essential work in the near future removing diseased ash trees. In 2024 and beyond, the aim of the Friends will be to continue to improve the park, which will reach its 150th anniversary in 2028. This provides a date to aim for, and to celebrate improvements and be proud of the park and its important role for the people of Winchester. And the article is accompanied by a photograph of a group of the Friends of St Giles Hill Park, including two of their youngest members, one of whom seems to be holding a spade which is as big as himself, but thoroughly enjoying it.
How we will remember them. On November the 11th, the Royal British Legion and Mayor of Winchester, Councillor Angela Clear, will mark the 2-minute silence on the steps of the City Guildhall. Members of the public are welcome to join and pay their respects. On Remembrance Sunday, there will be a Remembrance Parade which will feature both military and civic processions. The Remembrance Parade will leave the Broadway at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday, November the 12th, and will conclude at the Cathedral just before 10 a.m. Remembrance Service. This service is expected to be busy with limited spaces inside, but there will be live stream for those who are unable to attend. After the service, there will be an act of remembrance which will take place at the War Memorial outside the Cathedral at 11 a.m. In Horsford, there will be services hosted on November the 12th by St Peter's Church, St Mary's Church and St John's Church. St Peter's Church are hosting a parish communion remembrance service at 10 a.m, 12 p.m, with St Mary's and St John's Churches hosting remembrance services from 10:45 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. At St John's Church, services will be led by Reverend Heather Beery and will be live streamed. There will be also a Remembrance Morning Prayer at 10:50 a.m. hosted by All Saints Church in Horsford. In Bishop's Waltham, a Remembrance Day Parade will march along the High Street at 10:30 a.m. to the church and will return to St George's Square at 12:20 p.m.
a bid for Sir Bobby's semi-final shirt. The shirt, worn by Sir Bobby Charlton in the 1966 World Cup semi-final, will be auctioned later this month. The signed top was worn by the football icon in the 2-1 victory over Portugal on July the 26th, 1966, when he scored both goals in front of more than 94,000 spectators at Wembley, before England's victory over West Germany in the final. Sir Bobby died at 86 on October the 21st, prompting tributes from across the sporting world. An inquest on Wednesday concluded he died after a fall at a Cheshire care home. The shirt, put up for auction before Sir Bobby's death, is being sold by Derbyshire-based Hanson's Auctioneers on November the 14th, with a guide price of £50,000 to £80,000. David Wilson Turner, head of sports memorabilia at Hanson's, said, "England has some of the most passionate football fans in the world, and I'm sure many would love to own Sir Bobby's shirt. He deserves to excel because not only was he worn by one of England's greatest players of all time, it marks a magical moment in sporting history. The one and only time England have won the World Cup. England's epic 4-2 victory over West Germany took place 57 years ago. Nevertheless, fans constantly reminisce about 1966, the year England was recognised as the best footballing nation in the world." The shirt was originally donated by Sir Bobby to a charity auction after the 1966 World Cup. He autographed it, personally dedicated it to the successful bidder, and confirmed he wore the shirt in the game against Portugal. Now, in 2022, Diego Maradona's Hand of God shirt, worn to score a goal for Argentina against England at the 1986 World Cup, sold for a record £7.1 million. And I shall add here, as that's almost unbelievable, it was sold for a record of £7.1 million. Amazing. That was the highest price ever paid for a piece of sports memorabilia. In honour of Sir Bobby's passing, it would be wonderful to see his number 9 shirt exceed all expectations. Hopefully we can give this item the justice it deserves. And Charles Hanson, owner of Hanson's Auctioneers, said he anticipates bids reading £100,000. A memorial service celebrating Sir Bobby's life will take place at Manchester Cathedral at 2 p.m. on Monday, November the 13th. And this is accompanied by a couple of photographs. One is of the shirt that's going into the auction, which is a white shirt with the England emblem on it. But another a picture, I guess, is a projection of Sir Bobby Charlton at Old Trafford, 1937 to 2023.
Christmas shop caps off centre. A Christmas pop-up shop has opened inside a Winchester shopping centre. The Brooks has welcomed Mr. and Mrs. Santa Claus to the upper floor, filling the former Tot City unit. The seasonal store selling festive decorations and gifts is open every day until December the 25th. The Brooks' newest occupant, alongside its latest deals with retailers such as Sports Direct, means all the shops in the centre have been let out for the first time in decades. It was only fully let out for around a year at the turn of the millennium. Partners Mandy Chalk and Graham Budd, known as Mr. and Mrs. Claus, started the business 15 years ago, originally opening in one of the Winchester Cathedral Christmas market huts before moving into empty shops in the Brooks around 8 years ago to have more space. The Christmas-loving pair were thrilled to be welcomed back to the shopping centre under its new owners, Yarrow Estates. After 7 days of transforming the space, the store opened on Wednesday, November the 1st. Mandy, 57, who lives with Graham and their two daughters in Hinton Ampner, said, "We're really happy to be back again. Winchester is our stomping ground, and we've built up a bit of a following here over the years. People who come to the Christmas market come to find us too. We've had quite a few people in already. It's all the early people who love Christmas. We like the traditional items, but also the quirky stuff too. Mandy, a retired Barclays worker, and Graham, a painter and decorator, started the business as they wanted to do something together. Their daughters, aged 23 and 18, also come and help at the weekend to give them a break. Graham, 70, said, "We haven't really got anything like this in Winchester. Lots of shops sell Christmas bits, but not the whole thing like us. We're very niche. We have lots of ceramic stuff too that you won't find at garden centres. To see all the people come in with big smiles on their faces makes it all worth it. We really appreciate the Brooks for having us back." Simon Turpin, director and asset manager of Yarrow Estates, said, "The really significant thing about the Christmas shop being here is that the space is fully let out. It's wonderful that for the first time in 30 years plus, the Brooks is full. This shop is a quintessential part of Christmas in Winchester, and we're delighted to have them here. Everything is beautifully fitted, and there is stuff for everyone. Winchester is a very Christmassy place, and people come from all over to shop here." And the article is accompanied by a photograph of Graham, Bud, Mandy Chalk and Simon Turpin standing outside the newly decorated shop.
Siblings step up to help save centre. A pair of Winchester teenagers have raised more than £1,500 for charity by walking 30 miles in 2 days. Siblings Amelie and Ellis Haig walked from Winchester to Lyndhurst to raise money for the charity Fox's Future, a CIO which is aiming to purchase Foxleaves Girl Guiding Centre in the New Forest. The organisation was set up when it was announced that Girl Guiding would be selling 5 of its centres by the end of 2023, with Foxleaves one of the places listed to be axed. Amelie, 16, said that she was inspired to complete the challenge when she heard the news about the sale. A former girl guide, she visited Foxleaves many times for camps, residentials and activities. She said, "I decided I wanted to do something difficult that would attract interest and mean more to people would sponsor me." With her 14-year-old brother Ellis, Amelie plotted a route from King Alfred's statue along the Itchen Navigation to Southampton. Day 2 saw them taking the Hyde Ferry across the water and cutting across the New Forest, ending their journey at Foxleaves. The 30 miles took Amelie and Ellis 11 hours to walk over two days. The duo's mother, Isabel, has been a guide leader in Kingsworthy for more than 20 years. She said, "When we heard that the girl guiding was closing the centres, we were so sad. Foxleaves is a place that is steeped in guiding history, a place that young people of all ages can roam free, have adventures and make lifelong friends. With the increase in children's mental health, we need more of these places, not less. I'm so proud of these two, showing determination, resilience and passion for something they believe in." At the time of writing, the fundraiser has raised £1,708. To donate the fundraiser, visit crowdfunder.co.uk/p/walking-from-Winchester-to-Foxleaves. And there is a picture of Amelie and Ellis standing by the New Forest sign.
Work future on agenda. The University of Winchester will host a conference about the future of work next year. The future world of work, recruiting and retaining the people you need, takes place at the University's West Down Centre on Tuesday, January the 9th. A team of experts has been lined up to explore and explain how work will change and the implications for recruitment. One of the key speakers will be a futurologist, Dr. Nicola Millard. Just a little aside, I have no idea what a futurologist is, but I have visions of somebody at the end of the pier, but never mind. Dr. Nicola Millard, principal innovation partner at BT, whose presentation focuses on how to shape the future hybrid workspace. Dr. Millard said, "The future world of work was already being defined by digital technologies before the pandemic hit. Now, as old and new ways of working collide, we have a unique opportunity to rethink things to make work work for people, productivity, and the planet, whilst harnessing the best of both real and virtual worlds." Dr. Millard combines thinking from psychology, anthropology, computing, and business to develop strategies for the workplace. She was involved with some BT firsts, including the application of artificial intelligence into its call centers, experiments with home working, and helping to develop BT's Net Easy customer score. The attendees will have a chance to quiz their employees of the future at a Q&A session with a panel of students from the university and other local further education providers. And for more details, visit thefutureworldofwork.eventbrite.co.uk.
Another work-related article: housing provider proud to erase gender pay gap. Hampshire's biggest provider of affordable homes says it has eliminated the gender pay gap among its 850 employees. Vivid Housing has announced that steady progress over the past few years has enabled it to reduce the pay differential between male and female members of staff from 13.5% to zero. A company spokesman said, "For every pound earned by men, women earned exactly the same. This is a huge achievement of which we're incredibly proud. Through a rigorous set of benchmark salaries for each role, we're committed to rewarding and paying our staff fairly and making sure there's no divide in our workforce. Our employees should be paid according to the job they do, not a characteristic like gender or ethnicity. We value and recognise the importance of a diverse workforce to deliver our business objectives. It's our aim to have an equal representation of gender at all levels and similar roles across our business. We know we still have some improvements to make in terms of hiring more women into certain roles. For example, there are far fewer women working in our trade roles, but through our inclusive recruitment and unconscious bias training, we want to ensure we're hiring as many women as we can into these roles. We currently have 22% of women in trade management roles. Supporting women in finding development opportunities to step up and ready themselves for managerial and leadership progression is also a big priority, so we'll continue improving our approaches to do so." Duncan Short, Group Resources Director at Vivid, added, "Having a 0% gender pay gap is something we feel is a great achievement. Vivid says it has also made real progress in reducing the ethnicity pay gap to 4.3%. We'll keep promoting our inclusive culture and ensure Vivid remains a great place to work," said the company spokesperson. Vivid has 34,000 properties in Hampshire and the neighbouring counties of Berkshire, Surrey and West Sussex. The award-winning business is planning to build 90 homes at Newgate Lane, Fareham. An outline proposal by Vivid and Bargate was approved by government inspectors after the Borough Council failed to determine the application in time. The developers have now submitted a more detailed scheme, which must also be approved before work can start. And the photo is the photo accompanying the article is a photo taken of the staff of Vivid Housing, indicating the diversity of their workforce.
Co-op store opens again. The Co-op has opened its store in Chandler's Ford, which has been transformed after a 16-week programme of works and improvement. The store in Winchester Road, Chandler's Ford, supports 16 jobs and now opens between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. 7 days a week. New features at the store include in-store bakery, a Costa coffee dispenser, which is now part of the Co-op's meal deal offer, self-service tills and hot food. There is also a cash machine and customer parking. The store looks amazing with brand new refrigeration, fixtures and fittings. It has completely transformed and looks brand new. We would like to thank our customers for their support during the works. Our aim here is always to operate at the heart of local life and make difference in the community. We have worked to develop the range, choice and added services to create a compelling offer locally and conveniently, with a focus on delivering member value so that the people who own our business, our members, benefit every time they shop. Groceries are now available through online home delivery apps such as Deliveroo, Just Eat and Uber Eats. And I've been in there, and I must admit that all the refrigeration units are very tall. It's hard to reach for so.
The Country Pub serves up one of the best Sunday roasts. An East Hampshire pub has been recognised as having one of the best Sunday roasts in the country. The Thomas Lord in Westmeon was named as one of the top pub roasts in Hampshire by the website Muddy Stilettos, alongside the Red Lion in Odeham and the Old Mill in Hordle, Lymington. It was praised for its long-standing reputation for great grub, with a large range of menus available for breakfast, lunch, dinner and afternoon tea. According to their website, the Sunday Roast features a selection of roast meats including beef, pork and chicken, with a cauliflower and spinach Wellington available as a vegetarian option. The Hampshire Chronicle spoke to the general manager about their ranking, and they said, "It's amazing to hear. We usually have a waiting list. We are that consistently busy every Sunday, and it's always a fresh pub roast." The pub was also commended for its beautiful scenery, as it was described as a picture-perfect country pub surrounded by countryside and thatched cottages in a chocolate box village in East Hampshire. And the beautifully restored traditional village pub offers a range of real ales and mouth-watering meals 7 days a week.
Thank you. That concludes the extracts for this week. So thank you to our editors for selecting the extracts, and to the copying and memory stick preparation teams. And thanks and goodbye from our readers, Jill Russell.
Goodbye.
Norma York.
Goodbye.
And Andrew Parkinson.
Goodbye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye, and do have an enjoyable week. And when you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.